It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we ask the question, can we trust our own taste? When an expert raves about a Cabernet plump with ripe kiwi and Moroccan suede, can you taste all that? Our guest, journalist Lawrence Osborne, puts it to the test. His book is The Accidental Connoisseur, An Irreverent Journey Through the World of Wine. While the Sterns are getting their licks at the Big Dipper in Prospect, Connecticut, super cook Sally Schneider talks the new steak. It's healthy, it's good, and it comes from a duck. For a little tranquility, Scott Haas takes us to Tokyo for a private tea ceremony, and we celebrate the 101st birthday of the granddaddy of good eating. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, be jewelly, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape. Pop me a cork, French me a fry, crack me a nut, bring a bowl full of bonbons, chill me some wine. Keep standing by, just entertain me. Champagne me, show me you love me. Kid, love me, best way to cheer me. Cashmere me, I'm getting hungry. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, jump to it. Sent out for scotch, boil me a crab. Cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals. Just hang around, pick up the tab, and never outthink me. Just mink me, polar bear rug me. Don't bug me, new thunder burn me. You heard me, I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, send out for scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals. Just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me. Just mink me, polar bear rug me. Don't bug me.
being new with Thunderbird and me. You heard me, I am getting hungry.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's the man who tested his taste buds against the wine establishment. Our guest, Lawrence Osborne, wondered if he could trust his own palate. He went inside the wine world to find out. His book is The Accidental Connoisseur, An Irreverent Journey Through the Wine World. Then it's the new healthy steak from Uber cook Sally Schneider, Out with the Cow, In with the Duck. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's start the show with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Hey, Lynn, you know, it's getting warm out and it's becoming ice cream season. And we found such a great place for ice cream in Connecticut, not too far from where we live. Mm-hmm. Their specialty is toasted almond ice cream, inspired by those wonderful good humor toasted almond bars of our childhood, except this is toasted almond brought to the max.
It really transcends the good humor inspiration. I've got to tell you, the Big Dipper Ice Cream Factory in Prospect is not only makes just wonderful, true homemade ice cream, it's got an ambiance about it that reminds me of what a place selling ice cream should have been like in the 1950s. It's the kind of place where girls start working there when they're in high school. Mm-hmm. They go off to college. They come back and work there on their summer vacations. They get married. They then come back to work. I mean, it's just got this kind of wonderful family ambiance that once you start working there, you're part of the Big Dipper family forever.
Now, is this a place where you can go and sit down and eat the ice cream, or do you just buy it there?
No, there are booths inside. There's always a long line outside in the summer months. I think there are some picnic tables outside as well, but you can get pints to go. But it's a real old-fashioned ice cream parlor. There are booths, and on the wall there are all kinds of awards from the various Cub Scouts and baseball teams and hockey teams that the proprietor supports. I mean, it's a community center.
Lynn, when you were a kid, was good humor like a major deal with you?
Oh, yeah, the neighborhood stopped when you heard the bell.
And did you get toasted almond?
Well, when you said toasted almond, what I remembered was the pops with the vanilla mm-hmm. ice cream on the inside mm-hmm. and the chocolate and then the almond sort of crusty on the chocolate. Now, is that what you're talking about?
No, well, at least at the Big Dipper, there's no chocolate involved. It's a kind of creamy ice cream laced with these kind of sandy streaks of almond crunch and with a really powerful kind of nutty almond flavor. I mean, it really tastes like a toasted almond.
And the Big Dipper does this better than it ever was replica of it.
And one of the things I have to say that I love about Big Dipper ice cream is that it's rich. But it doesn't go over the line to being too rich. You know, there are a lot of these kind of boutique ice cream factories now, especially in the Northeast, I think, where they make ice cream that is so rich it's almost like eating sweetened butter. Mm-hmm. This is like ice cream
you can eat. I like eating sweetened butter.
Well, Jane may like it, but never mind that. This is ice cream you can eat like a five-scoop sundae and still walk out of the place feeling good.
Do they have other sensational flavors? I mean, things that send you into a swoon.
Yeah, there's a wide range of flavors. I mean, from from silly ones that, you know, they have cotton candy flavored ice cream, to very kind of deluxe, upscale ones. One of my favorites is one called Cafe Vienna, which is coffee ice cream kind of laced with cinnamon. But not so much cinnamon, just enough to give, just to make it different than coffee. That's just wonderful.
By the way, Prospect, Connecticut is a dream of a town. I mean, it really could be a destination drive. It's Connecticut at its finest. It's beautiful. It's old fashioned. It's unspoiled. And what could be a better drive in the spring or summer than going to the Big Dipper Ice Cream Factory?
Oh, sounds good to me, guys. Thanks.
Bye. Happy ice cream.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, every week you can hear them here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're checking out the site, don't miss signing up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. It's our humble attempt to make weeknight eating a little simpler. Every week we send you a new recipe, techniques, and shopping tips. And perhaps most importantly, it's free. So sign up at that center of all good stuff, splendidtable.org. Food expert Sally Schneider is one of those cooks with an innate style and a modern take. She makes dishes healthier without losing a jot of the good flavors. Sally's author of A New Way to Cook, and she's one of our regular visitors. Sally, good to have you back.
Thanks, Lynn.
What have you been working on?
Lynn, I've been working on a great alternative to steak, because I love a good steak once in a while. And my alternative is something that most people don't think of, and that is a duck breast.
You know, I have been waiting for America to discover this. Keep talking.
Well, of course, this is something that everybody in Europe knows and picks up at the supermarket at a drop of a hat. And finally, we are able to pick them up at the supermarket. Increasingly, they are available. And what you get with a duck breast is a little perfect steak with a texture of red meat, but with a delicious, slightly winey flavor. And the added bonus, if you want it, of the crispy kind of roast duck skin that we love so much.
Well, how about if you look at just the red meat? How does that compare in fat and that kind of stuff to beef?
Well, it's amazing. If you just take the meat without the fat, you have a little steak that has less saturated fat than a chicken breast without the skin. It is unbelievably lean. With the skin, you up the steaks considerably, but what you have is something that is comparable or less than steaks, depending on which steak you're using. And duck steaks proportionally tend to have less saturated fat than other meats.
So how should we shop for these things?
First of all, you will either find duck steaks in the poultry section or in the steak section. You never know which, because nobody knows quite where to put them. If you don't find them there, ask your butcher in the supermarket, because they're easy to get now. There are several choices. The least expensive is from the Long Island duckling, called the pekin or pekin duck. It's the smallest and most delicately flavored. These average about 6 to 8 ounces. Then you might find a Muscovy duck breast. This is from a duck of South American origins, thinner skinned and 40% leaner than pekin ducks. But they have a fuller flavor and more of a steak-like texture. and they're a little larger, about 3/4 of a pound each. Then the top of the line and most expensive is Magret, which are the large breasts from the Moulard duck, which is a hybrid cross of the Pekin and Muscovy, and the livers are used for foie gras. These are fed on corn in the weeks before processing, and the steaks are aged on the bones. They have a much more complex, winier, gamier flavor, denser texture. They are divine, but quite expensive.
Now, do these come frozen? Do they come fresh?
You'll find them in those kind of aseptic packages, the cryovac, usually one breast, or if they're smaller breasts, two together. And the wonderful thing about them is duck steaks freeze well, I think because they're densely textured and there's so much fat around them. So when I find them, I buy them and freeze them to keep on hand for a divine little elegant meal that takes no time.
Now, how do you handle them when you get them home? How do you like to cook them?
Well, first, a caveat about this. Duck steaks are best cooked medium rare or rare, like a steak. If you cook them longer and they get well done, they will taste kind of livery and lose much of their savor. So if you're a well-done steak person, this recipe isn't for you. Go to a whole roast duck recipe, like a slow roasted duck.
Okay.
And leave these. So you cook all these breasts the same way. You only need to gear the cooking time to the thickness of the steak. That's the only difference. So what I do is, if they're attached, I separate them. I score the skin, meaning I make a series of cross-hatched, shallow cuts across the skin. This will allow the fat to melt out as the breast cooks, making it much leaner and very crisp. If you don't want any skin at all, you simply remove it as you would skin from a chicken breast, which I do sometimes, but then I have to admit I cut up the skin into thin strips and throw it in a pan and crisp it up and then sprinkle it on the steak so that, you know, at least can have some of that.
So then what do? You do a slow sear on this?
Well, first I marinate them briefly in a dry rub of salt, sugar, and pepper, and that helps to tenderize them and bring up the duck's natural flavors. Then, if it's skinless, I simply sear them like a steak in a hot pan. If it has the skin on, I start them in a cold pan, skin side down. And as the pan heats up, it will draw out the fat from the skin and crisp it. Now, what will happen, Lynn, is you'll get this amazing pool of fat in the pan, which is this divinely delicious duck fat, as you know. In France, they use it to fry potatoes. So I had the inspiration one day to throw lightly crushed garlic cloves in the fat and basically cook them, steep them like a confit in the duck fat as the duck was cooking. They were heavenly with the duck. I've also thrown in sliced shallots to make kind of a fried onion effect, as you would a steak, for no extra work. And basically, that's all you do. You let the duck breast rest for a few minutes and then slice them thinly on a diagonal, which not only makes them more tender, but gives you a wonderful aesthetic effect.
And you fan them out if you want to.
And fan them out. And so you can serve them. They don't need a sauce. You can serve them just like a steak. My favorite accompaniment are oven-fried potatoes or parsnip fries. Any kind of pureed root vegetable or mashed potato, wild rice, simple risottos, you get the idea.
So essentially we've got the new red meat. Sally, thank you.
You're welcome.
Sally Schneider is the author of A New Way to Cook. Now you can get Sally's recipe for duck breast with thyme-infused honey and balsamic pan sauce on the website, splendidtable.org. And another great way to do duck breast, and just about anything else, is with this seasoning that I do in the food processor. I call it ginger garlic crush. The idea is that you make a big batch, stash it away, and then you use it in lots of different dishes. You grind up lots of garlic and fresh ginger. You pack it into a Ziploc bag. You just flatten it out so it's like a thin board. And then you freeze it. Now, when you need it, you just break off a chunk, and it melts really fast. Then you can rub it into fish, meat, poultry, vegetables. I put it in fast soups and stir fries. For teriyaki marinade, mix it with soy, vinegar, and sugar. For a Thai-style tomato soup, saute it with chilies, and then add tomatoes and broth. And you're done. Coming up, an accidental connoisseur, a chef's ultimate sacrifice to seasonal cooking, and inside the tea ceremony. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target store all in one. In addition to a complete Target store, Super Target features a bakery, deli, fresh produce, meats, and seafood. To find the Super Target nearest you, you can visit them online at Target.com. Lawrence Osborne has been called a smart new voice in the world of wine. Only he's not a wine writer, he's not a wine expert, and he's not a wine maker. Osborne is an English journalist living in New York, and he set out to test his palate, that is, his instinctive taste, against the opinions of the wine establishment. His book is The Accidental Connoisseur, an irreverent journey through the world of wine. Lawrence, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So how did your taste stack up?
Probably pretty badly compared in the minds of other people. In my own eyes, of course, it's a very much more complicated story because one's taste is one's taste, and one's lack of taste is one's lack of taste. So I started out in a sort of in negative mode with a lack of taste to see what would happen if I, you know, set out to acquire some.
You know, I think you've hit a nerve with this book because people have become so intimidated about wine and food. All the experts are telling us what's good, what's bad. So how do you really find out?
Yeah, well, I think I have to say, I think we live in a culture of experts, not just in gastronomy, but also, of course, in medicine and psychiatry and all kinds of things. So we live in a culture which is very much obsessed with the great critic. We defer to people, and sometimes, of course, we should. No doubt, the wine encyclopedias and experts, you know vastly more than I ever will about, you know, all kinds of things, and I defer to them. But taste is a bit awkward, isn't it? Because should we defer to the taste of other people, given that taste is something which is supposed to be the sign, the inner signature of our own identity? So that's a very precarious thing to defer to somebody else about, in my opinion.
Well, you actually went after this firsthand experience. Well, tell us about the journey.
Well, what better way to learn it than to actually go to the places where it's produced? So I thought, okay, I'll set off. I'll go off to California and see what transpires, and I'll go off to France and Italy thereafter. And that became sort of a watershed for me, because when I was in the places where the wines are actually made, then something of the logic of the wines began to, you know, become apparent to me, and I began to be able to memorize them.
Is there, I mean, you went to California, you went to France, you went to Italy. Is there a California taste?
There certainly is. You know, people kept talking about New World taste, Old World taste. And at the beginning, I wasn't quite sure what this meant. But, you know, almost the first venture that I made was to have lunch with Robert Mondavi. And at Mondavi's lunch, he served it up to me on a plate, as it were. He gave me some French wines to taste and some his own wines to taste.
Uh-huh.
And it certainly showed me how there is indeed an Old World palate and a New World palate, and they're very different. I wonder if New World palate could be otherwise expressed as a kind of English-speaking palate.
Is this the palate of the big fruit and the easy-to-drink kind of wine?
Well, think about what English-speaking peoples grew up with. I mean, the whole wine and food culture in the English-speaking world is extraordinarily recent. I mean, it's only really in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, our tastes are formed by very childish flavors in many ways, very overpowering in some way, the kind of things that children like, and children like sweet, fruity things. And this is changing, of course, but when you go, you know, I remember going to France when I was 23 for the first time and being struck by how acidic and kind of sour sweet people's tastes were, even those of children.
Yeah.
And I think these childhood experiences tend to kind of form us as we become adults, and they form our, you know, our tastes are the tastes of our culture.
Yeah, you grow up with soda pop and you like something that's sweet. It's logical. There's a name that keeps cropping up through the whole book, Robert Parker of the famous Wine Advocate newsletter. Tell me about him. How does he figure in this whole picture?
Well, Parker is a complex story. He was originally a lawyer who set off for France and, you know, a whole new world, and came back to the United States with a love of French wine, and probably at a time when that was a very unusual thing to have, and set up the Advocate at the end of the 70s as, you know, a sort of, as a way of taking the French down a peg or two by sort of demystifying a lot of their pretension.
Now, he rated wines. He gives wines a 90 or a 91.
Numerical scores, yeah.
And people walk through wine shops, and I've been one of them, you know, with, this wine's a 90. I think I'm going to try it.
Yeah. And this is just a simple mathematical way of simplifying the whole thing. But this defeats the whole purpose, obviously.
But now
imitated by the Wine Spectator and everybody else. So.
But I guess the question comes back to your whole thing about taste. So this number
is taste numerical? No, of course not. No.
Do we trust ourselves anymore, or do we have to be told?
No, we don't. We have to be told. But, you know, when we think now that it's a sort of responsibility of the individual to forge his or her own.
The question that comes to mind is, do you think wine should be made in a way that everybody can understand and appreciate?
Of course. Absolutely. It's one of the reasons for writing the book, isn't it? Because, you know, I was always going to these wine occasions and feeling like the fool at the court, you know, not really, always kind of ashamed and terrified of what would come out of my mouth. And I felt a kind of deep resent about this. You know, of course, this is nonsense. This has to be broken down.
Mm-hmm.
But what has to be broken down, of course, is oneself. I think one can, you know, construe this whole thing as very much a sort of an exercise in self-discovery without sounding too touchy-feely and ridiculous about it. But you know, but it is touchy-feely a bit. I think you are sort of setting out to find out who you are.
Yeah, the personal choice.
Exactly.
Lawrence Osborne, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Lawrence Osborne is author of The Accidental Connoisseur, An Irreverent Journey Through the Wine World. I'll have my own personal gripe about learning about wine. Experts are always saying that the best way to learn is to just sample until you find what you like. Well, when they hand me their credit cards to pay my bills, I'll do just that. I believe a little reading goes a very long way, and you don't have to have a PhD to do this. I have a couple of favorite books. Now, the first one is the Wine for Dummies series. It's solid, it's easy to understand information, and you can dip in and out of it to get what you want when you need it. The second is Andrea Immer's books, especially her Great Food, Great Wine book, where she offers all kinds of matching possibilities, and there is always something economical in the mix. The third choice is for when you want to dig deeper. It's Karen McNeil's The Wine Bible. Now you're going to get into geography, grapes, tastings around the world. It's a solid reference. So there it is, basic wine bookshelf for you. Andrew Dornenberg and Karen Page have been tracking the modern restaurant scene in a series of books. Their latest is about what America is becoming, a nation fascinated by cuisines around the globe. The book is The New American Chef, Cooking with the Best Flavors from Around the World. Andrew, it's good to have you with us. You know, one of the most striking examples in the book about influences on what we're eating right now is Japan.
Absolutely.
This is what I'm wondering. You talk about the fact that there's not much room to grow food in Japan.
Right, right.
Is that why the dishes are always these very spare-looking, you know, the one scallop on the rectangular plate?
I think it has a lot to do with the Japanese sensibility of art and nature. And again, yes, it's a mountainous island, basically. So you're not going to be able to grow a lot of, you know, produce year-round in that hard climate. And so since food is sort of, you know, hard to grow, it becomes more sacred. It's something more precious.
There's all these celebrations, you know, I'm thinking of the seasonal thing. How do the seasons play into the food?
Well, I think that in the American, you know, vernacular, everyone thinks of seasons as four seasons. And in Japan, since the seasons are so short, it's a short growing season for a lot of things, or a fish like shad or something runs for such a short period of time, that gets reflected and celebrated. You know, to me it sounds rather complicated, but it also makes me have a very deep appreciation if I see a certain Japanese mushroom in the market here in New York or wherever I might be traveling.
Now, you're a chef, and what I think of is, if a season is really short for a chef, how much chance do you get to practice with something?
You don't get much practice, and I think that's where you have to really, A, do your homework, do your research.
You know,
if something does come in, you know, you have to get on the internet and read up on it so you can show it the proper respect. But again, though, yeah, you're not going to get a lot of practice with that ingredient when you have something only for a week. And again, I think of someone like Patrick O'Connell, who says, I've been owning, you know, I've had a restaurant for 25 years and I've had 25 seasons of tomatoes. And it's tomato season, you know, it's a month or two.
Right.
It's not 4 days, but even he's humble in front of a tomato still to this day. So I think to be humble in front of something that runs for 4 days, it makes far more sense.
What would run for 4 days, for instance?
That will be a fish or sometimes a plum or sometimes a mushroom. And again, you know, and in America, there's very few chefs who actually can do that. And that would be someone like Masa Takayama, who used to be a Ginza Sushi Co. in Los Angeles and has just opened up in New York City in the Time Warner building.
Uh-huh.
So he gets these things flown in. And actually, he's so strict about his fish. He gets fish from Japan that if there's a typhoon, he will have to close his restaurant because he won't get the Japanese fish that he wants to celebrate. So he'll literally close for a couple of days until fish comes back in from Japan.
Well, now, okay. The whole point of your book is looking at what's happening with American chefs today. Is that kind of mentality about the origins of ingredients, is that now starting to really play in restaurant kitchens?
Absolutely. And I think it plays every single day even more. I think that the top restaurants either have someone who's local producing something for them, that have something new, or something that's imported coming in. And so I think the chefs, the best way to get the best flavor is to respect the ingredient and know a lot about it and celebrate what's wonderful about it. And so the more the chef can celebrate what is absolutely bright and at the peak will make for better cooking, which will make for happier customers and more customers.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Dornenberg, thank you.
Great to be here.
Andrew Dornenberg is co-author with Karen Page of The New American Chef. Now, the book also talks about the strong influence Spain is having on chefs here. Now, Andrew gave us his recipe for a Spanish fish stew. It's dynamite. It's with potatoes and tomatoes and brandy. You can get the recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. As we talked about in our interview with Andrew Dornenberg, the change of seasons has such significance in Japan. So many subtleties are observed. In fact, so much of Japanese food is focused on ritual, especially the taking of tea. Reporter Scott Haas is in Tokyo.
Few ceremonies on earth that are not religious can tell us so much about a history and culture as the Japanese tea ceremony. I'm here at Restaurant Kazue in downtown Tokyo, and I'm going to find out in a few minutes just why the Japanese tea ceremony can tell us so much about Japanese history and culture. So we're heading into a private room here. I'll slide the door open. And I'm faced with a small private room with a long wooden table. There's tea and various things attached to the ceremony on the table, and there's a person standing in front of me. Konnichiwa, my name is Scott Haas.
Konnichiwa, my name is Akiko. I'm going to be the host for today's tea ceremony.
It's a pleasure to meet you. You're wearing something traditional.
Yes, and this is a kimono, and very traditional one.
What do we do to get started?
OK, Okay, and I'm clean up the tea container first.
It's a small brown lacquer container on a round platter.
Purify is one of the important factors in the tea ceremony.
Purification of everything you're working with. Uh-huh. You're moving very slowly, and it's making me think and move more slowly too. Mm-hmm. And I find that very relaxing. Is that part of the ceremony?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Is this really part of Japanese tradition to be more meditative?
Yes, I could say so. And this is one of the main reasons I started to run tea ceremony, because it relaxes me.
Mm-hmm. So you're pouring the water in the bowl.
Yes.
The hot water over the green tea. Beautiful color.
And I'm mixing up.
You're making it into a lot of froth, a lot of bubbles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And why is that?
It makes the green tea more sweet, because otherwise it's very bitter.
How old is this ceremony?
Around 500 years old.
500 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You're a modern person. You live in Tokyo. It's one of the biggest cities on Earth. It's very busy. How did you get interested in the tea ceremony?
Tea ceremony is related to many Japanese other culture things, like ceramics, like these tea bowls.
These bowls are beautiful.
Yes.
That's right. Ceramics are part of Japanese tradition as well, right?
And cooking also. And I'm interested in the flowers.
What do you mean by interested in the flowers?
Flower arrangements.
Flower arrangement.
Yes, which called ikebana in Japanese. In the tea ceremony, it's important thing is simple, make it simple. So flower arrangement is very simple.
I find that so interesting because in walking around Tokyo these past few days, it's not a simple place.
No.
It's busy. It's a little chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm very happy here, but it's not a simple place. Are you responding to Tokyo? Is that like, creating a different world here?
Maybe. I make a bow and say thank you for the tea to the host.
Okay. How would you say that in Japanese?
Otemae chōdai itashimasu.
Okay. Thank you for the tea. It's very delicious, and the reason it's delicious, and I mean, I've had green tea before, but this is tastier than other green teas because it tastes so fresh. You feel not as if you're in a lovely room like this indoors, but instead you feel as if you're in a field, you're outdoors and you're a forest. It tastes as if you can smell the grass and hear the birds, and it feels like a spring day. It's very lovely. So, may I have another sip?
Yes. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much for making me part of the ceremony. It's an experience I won't forget.
My pleasure.
Reporter Scott Haas is the author of Are We There Yet? Perfect Family Vacations and Other Fantasies. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge, and I can't quite leave Japan. This week's question is about that tea ceremony we just heard. The question is, what usually precedes the making of tea in a formal Japanese tea ceremony? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. The number's 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what often precedes the making of tea in a formal Japanese tea ceremony? It is a meal, but not just any meal. In a formal Japanese tea ceremony, three courses are served, each with its own meaning. Each object and utensil will be as exquisite as the host can afford. And the key here is that this is an aesthetic and philosophical experience as well as a sensual one. The first course is called the rinsing of chopsticks, and this is where foods simmered in broth are served, and there also might be some grilled things. One source I found says that the chopsticks for the meal should be made of fresh cedar. Can you imagine that aroma? Now, the second course is all about the theme of most Japanese food, reverence for nature. Foods from the sea and the mountains are eaten. And another important tradition here is the idea of equality and balance. Each guest takes turns during this course, serving the host. Finally, fragrant things and sweets are served. And there is always a pitcher of salted water with browned rice in it. This symbolizes the last of the rice. Now, part of the ritual in this course has each guest cleansing their own utensils. A sweet is offered, and then the guests retire to a garden. Now is when the host prepares for the actual making of the tea. The Zen belief is that you can experience the universe in a bowl of tea.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Dana on the line from Carmel, California. Hey, Dana, what's up?
What do you want to talk about?
I'm kind of cheating because I have two questions, but if you can only answer one, that's fine. I'll talk very fast. You have mentioned in the past, and of course every cookbook I come across mentions regarding Oriental cooking, Szechuan peppercorns. Now, I know they have been banned in this country for a while.
Right.
What can you use as a substitute for that flavor? And my second question is, in terms of brining, which you might do with your chicken or whatever, the solution is kosher salt, sugar, and water, etc.
Right.
How much of that sugar and salt is absorbed, say, into your chicken breast, and is it deleterious if you are on a low-sodium diet?
Okay. Can I do number two first?
Sure.
Because I have to think about number one.
Okay.
If you brine with the sugar and the salt, a fair amount is absorbed. And that's what makes things juicy. And that's what makes things, you know, taste so good when you brine.
Uh-huh.
And if you are on a low-sodium diet, don't brine.
Okay.
You know, but if you're on a low sodium diet, you can do all kinds of marinades and, you know, you can use high seasonings of all kinds that you won't miss not having the salt. But brining, yeah, it is absorbing the salt.
Okay.
Okay. Now, substitute for Szechuan peppercorns. I'm thinking of the flavor, and they always remind me of eating. It's sort of a faint citrus taste, and it's woodsy, and it always has this cool sense to it, and yet it has a kind of heat that almost numbs your whole palate. It's a very strange combination, and I'm hard pressed to think of a substitute for it because I can't think of anything that has quite that combination of flavors. I'm just thinking,
things like fenugreek come to mind, but fenugreek is too distinctive and it doesn't.
Yes, it might overpower.
Yeah, and Sichuan peppercorns, you know, we talked to Fuchsia Dunlop, who has, who wrote the book Land of Plenty, wonderful
yes.
book on Sichuan cooking. And she goes on at great length about the flavor of the peppercorn, and it's actually called a numbing flavor in Chinese.
Oh.
Oh, boy. You could try fresh ground allspice.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Follow me on this. It's a weird idea, but this might work. Throw some allspice into a pepper mill. Okay?
Okay.
Grind that. Have some fine grated lemon zest. All right?
Yes.
And some dried hot chili.
Okay.
Mix that together, and I think it's not exact, but it's going to be close.
Okay.
Okay.
Would you use the dried lemon in that comes in
you
a jar?
Could.
Or would you?
You
use
could.
Fresh?
You could, and you could try grinding it. Although I don't want to stop up your grinder.
Uh-huh.
You could use the dried lemon peel, but I love the idea of the fresh lemon peel. You don't need a lot of it.
Yeah.
Not a lot of it at all. But there is always that citrus overtone, and I think the allspice berries, fresh ground, have an incredibly flavorful quality. You know, this is one of those deals where nothing tastes like a Sichuan peppercorn, so then you try to come close to it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay.
Is there any idea when they might lift the ban?
My understanding of the ban is that it's actually been around since the 1960s.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And in fact, there was a recent article back in February, I think in the New York Times, and I remember because I was foggy on this and it laid it out, and it was saying that the whole source of this is that the bush that produces Sichuan peppercorns is a member of the citrus family, and there is a bacteria that forms a canker on certain citrus plants that exist in China, that if they come into this country, they can ruin our citrus crop.
Oh.
But the ban on Sichuan peppercorns was never really enforced until about a year and a half ago.
I see.
But the article talked about the fact that if you were Chinese or you were known to a shop, you know, that a Chinese dealer, that there were still peppercorns to be had. But the problem is, of course, if you don't have those connections, you can't get them. And there's evidently no absolute proof that the Sichuan peppercorn carries that canker, but because it's in that family of plants, it's banned.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is. It was in February in the New York Times.
And okay,
it,
you know, so if you I'll look that up.
Yeah, look it up. But I would say, try what I suggested.
Okay.
It's gonna
oh, I
come
sure
close.
Will.
Okay.
Well, thank you. You have demystified some of the aura about that Sichuan peppercorn.
Hey, you're welcome. You
thank
take care,
you.
Dana.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Call us, 800-537-5252. Chris is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hey, Chris, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I was raised by this wonderful Depression-era farm-raised mother who was always preaching to us of trichinosis or trichocytes and mm-hmm. that we had to make sure to cook the holy bejeebers out of pork because
right.
that was the only safe way to eat it. So my question is trichinosis and such still a problem or is that a thing of the past?
Well, trichinosis is supposedly a thing of the past, but as you know, we've got other problems now. We have E. coli, we have salmonella, we have, you know, what's now gone has been replaced. And trichinosis still does pop up occasionally. But here's the good news. Most harmful bacteria, not all, but most, kick the bucket at 137 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, if you cook pork to 150 degrees,
okay,
it may still have a blush of pink, but most, the E. coli, the salmonella, any trichinosis will have met its demise.
Wonderful.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Chris.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Call us, 800-537-5252. This is the thing about pork. We get very nervous if we see a blush of pink. Now, obviously, you don't want it rare. But an instant reading thermometer is the key. 150 degrees. When you take it out of the oven or out of the pan, it'll cook a little bit more. Keeps cooking maybe to 155, but it's going to be safe. So call us, guys. 800-537-5252.
We've got Elizabeth on the line. She's calling from Troy, New York. Elizabeth, hi, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have a friend who will be going to Tuscany this May, and she's offered to bring me back something from the region. Now, olive oil seems to be a bit obvious. Since you're an expert on Italian cooking, I was hoping you might be able to suggest something.
Oh, let's see now. From Tuscany. Where is she going to be in Tuscany?
You know, I'm really not sure what her itinerary looks like right now.
There's a couple of things that come to mind. There is a bean, and it is one of the great beans in the world. And it is available in fancy food shops that, you know, and it's wildly expensive, and there it is not necessarily wildly expensive. It looks like a pregnant lima bean. It's a big white bean. It has different names. It's sometimes called the Corona, sometimes called the Gigante, sometimes called the Bianchi di España, the Spanish white. But this bean tastes like meat. And it's a dried bean, and you cook it, and you toss it with good Tuscan olive oil and some onion, and some red onion, obviously, because it's Tuscany, and you cook the bean with a lot of sage and garlic and olive oil in the water.
That sounds great.
And you could eat it just like that. I mean, it's fabulous. It's absolutely fabulous. But you can also make one of the great antipasto salads of Tuscany with it. So that bean is one thing. Okay. Of course, there is Prada. I mean, I realize you can't eat it, but, and the other thing, by the way, is that if she's in Florence, some of the best handmade shoes in the world are at Tania Crespi.
Right.
Now, enough of the fashion take here. Back to the food. Do you know the other thing that she might be able to get? And it may be on the edge. In Tuscany, especially northern Tuscany, chestnut flour is used a great deal.
Oh, you know, I've read about that.
Yes, and chestnut flour goes off in a very short amount of time. But what people do in the mountain areas is they dry the chestnuts, and then they grind them as they need them. And if she can smell the flour before she buys it, it should smell sweet and incredibly fresh. There should be no sense of sourness or staleness. If she could bring that back for you, you could cook it like polenta. There's
a
very famous cake that's made in Tuscany with olive oil and honey and the chestnut flour. It's a big flat cake, and you put rosemary and raisins in it.
Okay.
And you can find that recipe in any good Tuscan cookbook. But chestnut flour could be wonderful. And there are little fried fritters that you do. You make a fritter. You make a batter out of it with a little sugar, and you deep fry it, and you stuff it with fresh ricotta.
Nice.
Oh, it's so good. The ricotta is cold and the fritter is warm. The other thing is, you know, olive oil that you would never see. You know, olive oil from very tiny producers, from very tiny vineyards.
Right. I know my fiancé had said maybe like an estate bottled olive oil might be something interesting.
Yeah. And like, for instance, if she can come across Biondi Santi. B-I-O-N-D-I and then dash S-A-N-T-I. They are one of the great makers of Brunello di Montalcino wine.
Oh, okay.
Now, she'll need a bank loan for the wine. The wine will be fabulous, but their olive oil is to die for, and there's very little of it.
Oh, great. I will tell her.
They're near Siena.
Great.
So now she has four suitcases plus, well, she can buy a Prada bag. I mean, okay.
If she's not bringing me, I guess she can look for pregnant lima beans and some wine.
You'll be a cheaper date. Hey, thank you, Elizabeth.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. This year, James Beard would have been 101 years old. Now, if you've never heard of James Beard, you're probably thinking, so what? But trust me, if you like to eat and you usually like what you eat here in America, you probably owe something to Jim Beard. He was one of the founding parents of the great food movement of the 20th century. Now, one of James Beard's best friends and fellow food experts, Marion Cunningham, is on the phone. Marion's latest book is Lost Recipes. Marion, good to talk to you.
It's a very good treat to have a conversation with you, too. It's been too long, dear.
Absolutely. You know, Marion, something I've never asked you. How did you and Jim Beard first meet?
We met in the first classes he gave in Seaside, Oregon, many, many years ago. And he selected a couple of us to assist him. So one thing led to another, and it was a wonderful experience for me. Because ultimately, I started to travel with him And I saw places in the world I never had seen. We went everywhere. And he gave me a life, really, of work and so forth. It was a gift falling right out of the sky.
You know, put him in context for people who maybe don't know who Jim was. What was his significance in the food world?
For one thing, he was a perfect mix of a home cook. He had a wonderful mind and a wonderful palate, and he knew how to put things together. He knew how to correct fallen dishes and on and on and on. His ability to taste critically was tip-top. And so he had all the right things going for him, and he loved doing it.
He was a good writer, too, because he wrote a lot. He did a lot of books.
He did do a lot of books. I think I counted them at one time. Oh, there's something like 13, 15.
Yeah.
It's up, way up there. He had a lot of different talents. His memory stunned people.
Now, you said his style was one of a home cook, and I think that's one of the things. You look at his cookbooks today, and you want to just go into the kitchen and make his recipes.
Yes, you do.
There's very little about them that's dated.
That's right.
Do you have a favorite James Beard recipe?
I loved his curry recipes.
Which curry? Which one?
Well, I'd have to pull the book down and take a look. And there's one in particular. It's right kind of in front of my eyes here. You want me to grab it?
Sure, yeah.
Wait a minute. Let me look at 157, I think. What I'm looking at right now is probably one of the best books of his. He has a lot of them. They're all splendid. But this is the one that contains most everything that he did. And it's James Beard's American Cookery. It's a huge book.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to only get one, it would be the one you should buy. I still make this occasionally. It's curried shrimp with pilaf, and that is very, very good.
Well, Marion, thank you for talking to us about James Beard.
You're very welcome. He's worth talking about.
Certainly is. Thank you,
thanks,
dear.
Thanks for calling.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Marion Cunningham's latest book is Lost Recipes. That classic James Beard book she talked about, it's called American Cookery. Now, Marion left us with one of her favorite curry recipes, chicken fruit curry salad. You can get it on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this grace. Heavenly Father, keep us alive. There are 10 for dinner and food for 5. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. You can register for it right on the site. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. John Marston produced the tea ceremony piece. Thanks to Japan Airlines for getting them to Japan. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.